This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 92 of the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or even streaming media. I'm Mike Parkin, your host, and joining me, as usual, is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
So we're in that period, Rich, that sort of dead spot just before Christmas when the DTV distribution world just sort of seems to dry up. And we're sort of left with box sets and cinema releases and TV seasons and things like that. In fact, I believe this week, right at the beginning of December, there's been no DTV releases whatsoever.
Not as far as I could tell. And so obviously nothing really charted, no chart to speak of. Which the last couple of years we had a couple of animated.
Carey.
Yeah, we had the Mariah Carey All On Christmas film. And then I think that was 2 years ago. And then last year we had The Littlest Reindeer, I think, if I recall correctly.
Right. Yeah,
and they were kind of holding the fort.
I thought you were just going to say they were kind of terrible.
Oh, I haven't seen them yet, although Littlest Reindeer is on Netflix, so I might be watching that.
Jesus.
But the Mariah Carey one I've watched a little bit of as well a while back. But yeah, so it's really quiet this year as of this moment. So I don't know if there'll be anything else coming up in December, but I would expect not a lot, at least until after Christmas. And then I expect things will sort of start ramping up again. But, you know, that's not so bad because it's hard enough sort of keeping on top of even a handful of releases every week.
That is true.
So, and I'm very keen to start doing the stats on, you know, what we've had this year and what sort of numbers we've got.
And, that's right.
And we've got to start thinking about our awards, which will be in our next episode. So still lots to think about.
Absolutely. Now, there was one recent release I just want to mention. And that is The Night Hunter, starring Henry Cavill and Ben Kingsley. This is as close to an American version of a Nordic noir. So Henry Cavill stars as a police officer who deals with sex trafficking and sex crimes, that sort of thing. And Ben Kingsley, along with a young woman, are sort of vigilantes who actively entrap paedophiles, and it's really, really interesting to sort of see them work. And so both of them end up sort of working the same case from different angles. As I said, it's the closest I've seen. I'm a big fan of sort of the Nordic noir kind of series of, you know, things like the Department Q films and The Hypnotist and things like this. And this is that kind of film. If you're a fan of that sort of thing, The Killing, The Bridge, that sort of TV show, I highly recommend The Night Hunter. It's very good.
Yeah, I've been quite curious about that one. The idea of Ben Kingsley as a vigilante gets me interested right away. There's quite a few. There's another film that he was doing sort of in a similar vein, I think, which was released over here as Death Watch, I think, which was where he was running around planting bombs or something, which we're quite curious about. But the film that came to mind when, because of it being like a serial killer, is it a serial killer film?
It's it's more a guy who's gone totally under the radar and managed to kidnap loads of girls over the years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was one that Ben Kingsley did years ago called Suspect Zero. Which was another sort of post-Seven kind of movie. I think Aaron Eckhart and Carrie-Anne Moss were in it as well. But that one, I tried like twice to watch it and just couldn't get on with it. And I keep thinking that's a film that I should revisit. And I was tempted to sort of do a little Ben Kingsley double bill with Night Hunter.
You've piqued my interest now, Rich. I'll have to dig that one out.
Anyway,
that's beside the point because that's not part of our show tonight.
No.
So tonight we are going to be reviewing Rise of the Foot Soldier 4, aka Rise of the Foot Soldier Marbella. We have a short shot, which is Blade of Honor, And we're going to round up with our DTV throwback, which this week is the excellent Tix. So let's crack on. So our main review this week is Rise of the Foot Soldier, Marbella. Craig Fairbrass taking up the character of Pat Tate once again. This is the second prequel following on from Foot Soldier 3, the Pat Tate story, and picks up not long after the first film, that previous film ended. Pat's out of prison. He's running a nightclub in Southend. He is the king of pills. But his supply is starting to run dry and he's got unfinished business back in Spain. So off he heads to basically kill the person who set him up. But as usual with Pat, things just don't go as planned. But, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel is that he makes a new connection for his pills to supply his ecstasy. But again, there's a catch. Now, Rich, I really enjoyed Foot Soldier 3. I in my review of it at the time, I said it was like the Southend version of Scorsese's Casino.
Right.
it was on that sort of grand scale. It was incredibly violent. You know, there was lots going on. It was very, very stylishly done. This, for me, isn't as good. I think the story isn't as tight. It's a bit of a Shaggy Dog story at times. You know, you've got that whole sequence of sort of misadventures of his two friends who end up in Amsterdam. And, you know, for a lot of the film, Pat is just kind of sort of like spinning his wheels, you know, waiting for things to happen. And, there is some great moments of violence in it. There are some great little moments.
Courtesy of Dan Stiles.
Yes, indeed.
Coordinator.
Yeah, we should give a shout out to Dan. Because he does some really good work on here. That scene in the with the trio of heavies when he goes with the other guy.
Yeah, the one that's bathed in red.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
the one.
Yeah, that's a standout scene. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very good. But you know, I don't know. There just moments of this is just sort of you know, the scenery is nice and everything, but you're just kind of waiting for things to happen a little bit. But you know, it's. And the other thing is, it's 84 minutes, and it felt longer for me. You know, I thought at times it sort of was dragging a bit. But overall, I'd say, yeah, it's not as good as the previous one, but I was still relatively entertained by it.
I do get what you're saying about the Shaggy Dog story kind of thing. It is a film that doesn't really have a tight plot. It is kind of... from here to there, different stuff happening, and that becomes a particular problem in my view at the end, where for a climax the film is suddenly focusing on a boxing match between Nigel Benn and Gerald McLennan.
This what really interested me, because you know, I didn't realize that the boxer, because you see the boxer earlier on, like, and I didn't realise it was actually meant to be Knight or Ben, but you know, the film is really explicit that this guy, and you know, and which I thought was really strange, that he, you know, his estate would allow his name to be so closely associated with the Essex Boys, as it were, you know.
Well, it seems that they're quite proud of that. I think. I mean, he distances himself from it, I think, now, because from what I was looking into, he's a born again Christian, and so he didn't really want to be involved. Hmm. But do you know who plays the boxer?
Is it his son?
It's his son.
Yeah.
So
he was really good. I have to say, you know, he's brilliant. You know, in his boxing scenes, he looks the business. He really does.
So that does. I mean. That's very interesting in itself, to realise that Tony Tucker, which is Terry Stone's character, that he was a friend of Nigel Benton's, he was his bodyguard and stuff, and to look up the, you know, to go online and see that's all true, you know, that's all real stuff that they're recreating. So that's another aspect of the story which I found quite fascinating. But for a climax for the film, it just seemed to be, we're focusing on something completely irrelevant for, you know, spectacle's sake. And then the sort of the final moment, the final sort of real climax of the film, which is sort of happening in tandem, where in its own sort of way, Pat gets his just desserts in a kind of way that I quite like. But that doesn't offer any spectacle, so therefore it feels like they kind of added the fighting. But that is interesting. But yeah, so the film sort of meanders, but I had a lot of fun with it. I mean, these are nasty people doing nasty things to mostly other nasty people. There's a few cases because when we first reintroduced to Pat Tate at the start, he does knock out a guy for literally no reason whatsoever. He gets bumped in. He's even the one who bumps into.
It's Pat who bumps into him and then knocks him out.
So the film at regular intervals does get him doing things that are really nasty because you do like him. You know, Craig Fabrass is brilliant in this kind of role of these charismatic hard men.
Yeah,
you know, it's just,
and he's completely amoral, isn't it? I mean, the thing is, you know, within this world, there's no qualms about, you know, there's nothing about sort of like a code of honor or anything like, you know, honor among thieves or any bullshit like that. It's everyone out for himself, you know. And Pat is probably the most self-centered person you can come across, you know. So when you know, a particular character offers him, you know, offers to take him on to sort of betray his boss, sort of thing, and you're thinking, yeah, he's got to do it, and he got no illusion about him going, no, I got to stick up for my boss, kind of thing, you know, or this guy I'm helping out. No, he's likely to turn on him in a second.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting, and I do enjoy. It's quite interesting the way this franchise has sort of developed, because it started out as a football hooligan.
Yeah,
story, basically. And then there was a little sequel to that, and then they kind of decided to go, you know what, let's make this about Craig Fabrass as Pat Tate, let's put the focus on him, and they'll do the, and then they did the prequel, and so this is the sequel to the prequel, and they've properly made them into just sort of straightforward gangster movies now. And the scenery looks really good. I mean, it's a bit like the Jonathan Safran movies, like We Still Die the Old Way and stuff like that. You know, they go abroad and they shoot these. They've got these fantastic locations abroad, and as well as, you know, the local stuff. But this one is, for the most part, is in Marbella.
Yeah.
And please excuse me. But the funny thing is, so this is all around the Rettenden murders. This is what the Essex are known as, sort of the Essex boys kind of stories, and this is kind of Tony Tucker, played by Terry Stone. This is his sixth go at that character. And like Craig Fabrass, we've gone back in time now. So this story is like early 90s. But Terry Stone first and Craig Fabrass first played these characters like in the 2000s somewhere.
I can't remember. 15 years.
Yeah. And now they're
15 years older, and they're supposed to be playing 15 years younger.
Yeah. You know. And it was just funny because I watched The Irishman this week, which has, you know, all the technology to make Robert De Niro younger for those kind of things. So if this was a big budget movie, they would be doing that, but they can't. But it's not detrimental to the film at all. It's just kind of funny.
So that's really funny because you can imagine them sort of like, you know, sort of retrograding Craig Fabrass to what he looked like in Cliffhanger.
Yeah, which, exactly. That would be what it would be about, really. But say, Terry Stone's got this sort of Fright Week thing going on, but he's having a ball. He's just having so much fun in that character. And him and...
Is he playing a character, though? You know, are there certain props on set?
You know? I don't know. So Tony Tucker and he... So he's it's him and... Roland Manoukian as Craig Rolf, those two and Pat Tate were the three guys who were killed in the Rettenden murders, the Range Rover killings, and these three have all been they've been in the foot soldier films from the beginning. I think they didn't really appear much in the set. I think they were in like a flashback footage in the second one, but they go back to the first film, so we're kind of, they've always been around. And Tony Tucker and Craig Rolf in this one like as you were saying, they kind of have this just random side story, adventure, comic relief thing going on. And I was just thinking when I was watching it, I was like, this is R2-D2 and C-3PO, or whatever, you know, double act you want to think of. But, they're not very nice people. They're just sort of getting up to no good and, getting in trouble and doing all the things that you would never have any guts to do yourself. It's quite wild.
Oh, and excuse me.
It's impossible, I think, not to sort of have a bit of fun with those characters, as well as enjoy the sort of hard nut stuff with Craig Fairbrass.
I was starting to worry for them actually when they ended up in Amsterdam. I was just wandering around. I thought they're going to end up in like a Hostel sequel or something. But there's a moment where they pick up these two women, and the women sort of like look and see, like, you know, the fact that they're carrying a satchel stuffed full of money, and they give each other a sort of meaningful look. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, yeah, they're going to rip her off. And then it turns out they don't, you know, they're still there the next morning sort of thing, which I thought was quite funny. Yeah, it was another minute I thought was quite funny. It was at the beginning when Pat comes in and into the club and he's in such a mood and everything. And then Tommy Tucker slips him some ecstasy in his beer. And he's just sort of sitting there and he's smiling, going, "You bastard." And he's sort of going, "Oh, you're the only guy I know who could still be angry and be on ecstasy." It's just the look on his face, I just thought was really, really funny. That ending as well is actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
And it is a good, a good sort of sleight of hand. It sort of sells you one thing and you start worrying about one particular character and then it sort of throws it the other way right at the end. And the funny thing is, in the previous film, you know the guy who's the bouncer at the nightclub?
I don't remember the previous film.
In this one, there's the guy who's like the main bouncer, the one who rings him up at the end to sort of tell him about the pills being a bit funny.
Oh, yeah, Josh Myers.
That's it. So in the previous one, he's the one who goes with Pat to Marbella in the first place, and they get into a bit of scrape. And I said in my review that their sort of antics are kind of like, it's almost like Sid the Sexist out of the Viz comics. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, and again, that ending, it's like Sid the Sexist. There's a sort of comeuppance he would have had, which just made me laugh, basically. It's just this sort of schadenfreude sort of scenario, which I thought was just really, really good. But I don't think, outside of the Foot Soldier films, I don't think I've ever heard the C word ever used half as much as it is in these films.
Oh, it's all the time. You're just waiting for it. There's a certain drinking game sort of desire to do it with that. It's like, right, when's the first F? When's the first C going to come along? And it doesn't take long.
It doesn't take long at all. Jesus, all over, it's almost like punctuation.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, that would be a suicidal drinking game if every time the C word comes up, you've got to take a drink. It's almost as bad as if you're sort of playing a drinking game in Suicide Squad. Any time there's a new track on the soundtrack starts, that's another one that's going to put you under the table very quickly. But anyway, okay.
So this film is directed by, it's the feature directing debut of Andrew Loveday, mm-hmm. who's regularly a producer. So his whole career up until this point has really been sort of as a producer, and also he's done a couple of roles as an actor. So in this film, he's playing the character of,
he's one of the heavies, isn't he?
He's like one of the main bad guys who mm-hmm. Pat goes and works for. Let me just check. Terry Fisher. So he's the one I think he meets up over in Marbella.
Yeah.
With the girl. Let me check. Charlotte, I think it is.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so he's been invested in this series in one way or another ever since the start. I think he was like an executive producer on the first film, and then he went up to producing the last one, and now producing and directing that. And I thought he did a really good job. There's, in his directorial debut. I mean, the film looks really good. It's really clean. As you say, the cinematography is good. There's, you know, all the choices, I think, sort of work. And I think any fans of, you know, gangster movies going back to stuff like The Business and to a certain extent like Football Factory and that will get a lot out of this film. I think it knows its audience and its audience will, you know, enjoy it, I think, hugely. This is the kind of film I would definitely recommend to people who enjoy gangster movies. It's not The Irishman. It's not that. It's not the same kind of, you know, that kind of thing. No, but they're both, of a similar vein. Yeah. You know, you can't really have one without the other. You can't say, oh, you know, this is the, you know, repugnant sort of violence and The Irishman is acceptable kind of thing, because they both basically do the same thing. And what I would say is that I didn't think this film was sleazy. Which is kind of something you expect from these films. And I think we watched one a while back that I thought was, you know, pretty sleazy. And this one was, you know, tasteful isn't the right word, but you know what I'm getting at.
There's a bit of TNA, but it's mostly done in a tasteful way. And the woman playing, is it Charlotte?
Yes.
The main actress?
Emily Wyatt.
She's got an incredible figure. In there, she doesn't need to be. She doesn't need to do nude scenes, to show off. Basically, she looks incredible in some of the dresses that she wears,
and her character's really strong. I think that's the main thing.
Yeah, that versus as well. She gets an interesting sort of character arc as it goes on. Now, this film is set in the 90s, early 90s.
Yeah, so it peaks at 1995, because I looked up at the time of when the match was taken, when the boxing match.
Oh, the boxing, yeah. So,
and it's got some great songs on the soundtrack, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, there's two that stand out, obviously. I didn't think it was particularly anachronistic, you know, because most of it's set in the Marbella. You know, you don't get a lot of the sort of English trappings of the period. But the film kicks off with Blue Monday by New Order. And then it ends brilliantly on Ebenezer Good by The Shaman, which I thought was inspired. Because the previous film used Happy Mondays, a couple of Happy Mondays tracks. But it helped because they had... Shane, what's the lead singer called?
Oh yeah, yes.
Shane something. He's actually in the film in the.
Sean Ryder.
Sean Ryder, not Shane. Yeah. I was thinking of Shane McGowan, I think. Yes, Sean Ryder actually plays the sort of fellow inmate at the in the prison in Foot Soldier 3. So he sort of lent a couple of songs to the soundtrack. But yeah, I mean that really helped sort of. Put sort of time and place to the film, having especially Ebenezer Good, because I think Blue Monday came out way before.
Yeah, that's why I was kind of a bit thrown as to whether it was the 80s or the 90s or whatever at times. Mm. But at the beginning of the film, Pat says he's just been in prison for 5 years.
That's right.
So it kind of pushes the timeline up a bit. I'm considering this. Based on the amount of Tony Tucker appearances across these films and the Bonded by Blood movies, I'm counting this as the sixth film in the Essex, what I'll call the Essex Boys cinematic universe.
Oh, yeah.
How do you rate it?
Not as highly as 3, but I still think it's pretty strong, even though there were periods where it sort of dragged a bit. So I'm going to give it a 7.
I'm going to give it an 8. I had a lot of fun with it, and I was like smiling to myself or whatever throughout, basically from beginning to end, even though I felt a little bit uncomfortable with some of the actions of the characters at times, kind of go with it. But I think it was very well done. And there's a post-credits scene, which sort of didn't really mean a lot to me, but I guess means in a way that they're going to try and do a Rise of the Foot Soldier 5, but being that the film ends with the Nigel Benn Gerald McLennan fight, which was very, very close before they were murdered, there's not a lot of time left to be able to do that. So we might not be seeing, I'm guessing, we might not be seeing a lot of Pat Tate if they do another one, but We love Craig Fairbrass, another great performance from him, very intense, and can't wait to see what he does next. Actually, he's got a couple of films called Villain and Muscle, I think they're called, which both look very interesting. So lots to come from him.
Our short shot this week is Blade of Honor. This is a sci-fi space opera entry, very much in the vein of Battlestar Galactica, in which a long-running war with some invisible aliens is starting to affect sort of the human fleet and sort of running out of ships and things. And we follow a elite squadron of fighter pilots, as they sort of disobey all orders to take on a cruise ship. Now, this stars Richard Hatch as the Admiral, and also Tim Russ. If you're not familiar with either of those names, Richard Hatch, of course, he played Apollo on the original Battlestar Galactica series back in the late 70s, early 80s, and also had a role in the reboot. Can't remember the name of his character, but he was a sort of dissident slash sort of prisoner. And Tim Russ played Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager. So you know, that's quite a coup for this sort of show. Now, there seems to be a bit of confusion, Rich. This is presented on Amazon Prime as a short film.
Yes.
Now, it has a runtime of 40 minutes, but in fact, only about half of that is the actual sort of narrative story.
Yes, the film is 26 minutes.
Yeah, and the rest of it is the cast and crew paying tribute to Richard Hatch, who unfortunately died back in 2017.
And some outtakes as well. So yeah, it's like the DVD extras, indeed, sort of added onto the running time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't mind this, I must admit. I mean, it is very derivative, and I don't think it had enough time to sort of flesh out its differences. There's a sort of religious quasi-cult element to sort of some of the storyline. The aliens are quite different. They're invisible, which kind of saves on the effects budget, I guess. The costumes are great. The scenery isn't too bad. The space battles are actually very well done. Mm. The sound mix isn't great, especially towards the beginning. Very bassy, I thought. It made it quite difficult to make out some of the dialogue. But overall, I thought this wasn't too bad.
Yeah, it comes from a sort of a fan film background. Mm. So it's a bit like I don't know if you've heard of Axanar or Prelude to Axanar.
I have indeed, yep.
And stuff like that. So it's from that community, which Richard Hatch was very involved with, I believe. And so that's why, and Tim Russ is as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of kind of fan film stuff out there with ex-Star Trek and Battlestar and stuff, persons. And the film, looking at the film itself, which is essentially a pilot or a first episode, like I think it was made like a Kickstarter kind of project. Mm. It tries to do a huge amount in 20 minutes or so. It's all about the world building. There's lots of interesting touches, like turns of phrase that the characters use that you think might be things they're saying wrong, but it's actually intentionally that, you know, they're using different language and different ways of expressing themselves. And there's all these sort of hierarchies and interplays between so you've got like Tim Russ character, say this kind of cult thing going on, and they are working with the sort of Starfleet kind of organization, the Admiral. They're called sort of in league, but they're, you know, sort of uneasy allies, I would say. And there's, I think Star Trek fans will enjoy seeing like Tim Russ and the guy who played Tuvok, Aaron Eisenberg, I think is his name. He died recently as well. So the film here is, you know, will be quite touching for fans of those two guys, Richard Hatch. I mean, Richard Hatch as the tribute film that follows the production was about, you know, months from passing away, and he didn't tell anyone at the time. And he just turned up and did the job, and everyone just, you know, had no idea just how ill he was, apart from the fact that they saw, you know, that he was ill and that, but he didn't tell anyone because he was very private and didn't want to impact the production or anything. So that's quite, I mean, if for any Battlestar Galactica or, you know, general Richard Hatch fans, this is kind of a must-see as his last role. The film, to my mind, peaked before the title comes up because the battle scene, the aerial battle scene, you know, Star Wars kind of thing, is really good. And that's probably the, you know, the big spectacle of the film before then the title kicks in at 6 minutes. And then we start getting all the characters, and they're introducing many, many characters, all with different relationships and that. We see some production value issues in some of the green screen, and there's a couple of the shots where it seems like they shot it full screen, but they've cropped it to widescreen, so like tops of heads are missing, and and the people are just way too close up. So, I don't think this film had a lot of money, and I think they probably did have to make some compromises in that. But for what they set out to achieve, and with the backing of people like Tim Russ and Richard Hatch, you know, that really goes a long way, and I think they did a really good job.
There's sort of dialogue scenes between sort of the Admiral, the Captain, and sort of a couple of the others, where the whole thing is done with all characters on screen at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that is a sort of a budget saving thing. So, you know, instead of sort of cutting to each character and sort of breaking the scene down, they sort of basically just sort of shot it all in one take, you know, sort of that sort of thing. There's some interesting elements to it overall, I think. And, yeah, I would have, you know, if this was an actual series, I probably would sort of watch the first few to sort of see how it develops and sort of whether or not it sort of really catches my interest or not.
This has been, from what we can see, as you pointed out on IMDb, it mentions five episodes, or at least five episodes, but all that we can see really is that this one has been released so far. So it might be that those others are in various stages of production.
Sure.
And we're not sure quite when we'll get to see those. I would be interested, you know, if, you know, an occasional 20-minute episode here and there, I'd be more than happy to sort of dip in and keep an eye on this series and how it develops. I mean, James Tyson Lee is also
he's really good. And, you know, he's one of those people, as soon as you see him, you go, you know, you're not sure where you've seen him before.
I think he was in Heroes.
He has done a lot of TV stuff, you know, but he's one of those sort of very familiar faces that you see and you go, oh, okay, you know, and sort of it gives it sort of that extra sort of bit of oomph, basically. It's like seeing Greg Grunberg, in something, you know, basically, you know, one of those sort of guys.
Yeah, and he was also, I'm just looking for his thing. He's done tons and tons of TV, isn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely loads. But yeah, I liked, so considering this is low budget, independently made, you know, struggling to get off the ground project, they did, you know, so well to get to this point. And hopefully the audience, you know, the intended audience for this will really get behind it, and then they'll be able to continue on those stories, because it's a bit like what with Doctor Who and stuff when, you know, when Doctor Who was off the air and the fans were sort of really getting behind independent productions.
Yeah, you know, shows about UNIT and things like that.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. You know, that is so much a part of the fan world, is, you know, developing projects like this that, you know, the fans can own themselves. Which is what I was really annoyed about with the whole Axanar thing, and
obviously Paramount.
With Paramount sort of really nailing down what they had to put the limits on and stuff, which was, you know, not good at all. But I understand why they do it. But, you know, It would be nice if they had a bit more freedom, but they just thought, oh, hang on a minute, these guys are getting a bit too big for their boots.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
They're getting a bit too much backing and power, or sort of thing, even though they're not going to make any money out of it. But never mind. Yeah, yeah, so Blade of Honor, well worth checking out. It's on Amazon Prime.
Absolutely. Check it out. Our DTV throwback this week is Ticks. From 1993, directed by Tony Randall. We'll get onto him later on. This sees a group of ne'er-do-well teens taken out into the woods for an out-of-bounds bonding session, kind of like Band in the Hand, by two very well-meaning sort of counsellors. And unfortunately, their camp just happens to be neighbouring a cash crop setup where some people are growing marijuana plants and using steroids in their mix to make the plants grow even faster. Unfortunately, those steroids are getting into the local wildlife, and some ticks in particular are breeding very, very largely in the neighbourhood. And you can imagine the sort of gooey chaos that's going to happen. Or can you? Are you prepared for ticks? Now, as I just said to you, Rich, since we've been doing this DTV throwback luck, and, you know, considering that I consider myself a bit of a film buff and everything, you've managed to sort of dig out films that I've never even heard of in the past, especially with Point Blank on that last episode, Jesus
Christ. Yeah, how did you miss that one?
How did that film exist with me not knowing about it? Sorry, that was two episodes ago. Of course, we had the Demolition High and Demolition New on our previous episode. Anyway, I digress. Ticks is the first one that you've come up with that, I've actually seen before.
So did you see it when it came out?
Yeah, I did. I actually did. I remember seeing the trailer for this and dug it out on rental.
Excellent.
I always thought that this was actually directed by Brian Yuzna, but it turns out he's just a
exec producer, I think.
Producer on this, yes.
Yeah. It's got his gooey stamps on it.
Absolutely, it does. So this stars a very, very teeny Seth Green.
Seth Green.
Who, of course, went on to be in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and he's one of the driving forces behind Robot Chicken and the voice of Chris on Family Guy and, you know, various other roles. But he looks...
The Austin Powers movies, people know him a lot.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But, he looks so young and very 90s-y in this, with his sort of... his sort of droopy hair and round glasses.
He was positively a veteran, I think, by this point, because he started out with films like My Stepmother is an Alien.
Right.
Which was the first thing he did with Alison Hannigan, who he went on to do Buffy with.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because they were both in that. And I think, say he was, I don't know, like 10 or so then. But yeah, he's been around a long time. But yeah, this was probably one of his most leading roles, I would have thought. Yeah. But
he's not the surprise in this film. He's not the surprise in this film. The surprise is the guy playing Daryl Panic Lumley.
Alfonso Ribeiro.
The other half of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And if you're a fan of Strictly Come Dancing, you would have seen him recently on that show as well. He won the American one years ago. I think he won it a couple of years ago, and he's sort of every time that Bruno wants a break on the British one, or his schedule clashes, they get Alfonso over to step in as a judge.
I'm
a Strictly fan, in case you didn't realise. But there you go. Alfonso Ribeiro is really, really good in this. This is
playing he's completely against.
Type, that's right.
Yeah. For what he became known as, which was Carlton Banks, the really straight yuppie character. Yeah.
But here he's this sort of lovable vandal kind of guy, you know, sort of lovable heavy, you know, with his dog, poor dog. He's a really good character in this film. The film's great. It is gooey as hell, and, you know, insects are not my forte, especially cockroaches. I fucking hate cockroaches. And these things, you know, the gooiness of the eggs and the spores and things just
This is the KNB folks.
It is the KNB folks. That's right. Yeah. But they do some sterling work. I also recommend, after you watch the film, is checking out the Good Bad Flicks on YouTube, because they did a sterling episode on this as well.
Oh, did they? I don't think I've seen that one. I'll have to
It's really good. Yeah, they did a really good job on it, and so went into its history and sort of, you know, how they did some of the special effects and things. The special effects in this, you know, not quite Aliens quality, but kind of getting there with this sort of scuttling. You know, the ticks when they're scuttling across the floor. There's a whole brilliant sequence set
in the vet,
the vet's office.
Yep.
With this thing with a syringe stuck out of it. It's just really, really well done.
She's messing about with that dog and its insides, and everything about that scene screams, walk away. Walk away now.
Just burn it.
She's
burn
just, this is strange. And it's all sort of writhing or whatever. And she just keeps trying to think. And they just go, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's, so some interesting sort of, you know, dialogue moments, you know, because they, you know, a bit of plot exposition. But it works really well when they sort of mention the fact that the ticks sort of, you know, they inject you with a sort of almost a sort of hallucinogenic serum that which sort of like, you know, stops you from realizing you've actually been bitten. You know, as happens to a couple of the characters, and you know, then makes them sort of hallucinate about what's actually happening. It's just really, really well done all the way through. This is a film that really stands the test of time.
Yeah, and everything is in there for a reason. It all sets up. So, I mean, some of it's a bit heavy handed, like, oh, they arrive in the woods. Oh, you've got a little tick. Oh, this is a woodland tick or whatever. And it just happens to be the same thing that they're going to deal with.
Yeah.
But
and
then,
this is how
you
kill them. Yeah.
And all the, you know, it starts out sort of slowly with the marijuana menace kind of posters sort of in the background, and some news broadcasts, I think, or something that's saying there's stuff going on in this area. And then we meet a couple of nefarious characters and they sort of give some exposition, and we pretty soon get a bearing on them being the main human villains, who are basically responsible for everything that happens.
Basically, yeah.
And it all leads to a big fire, which coincidentally happens to drive the ticks towards the cabin where the protagonists are staying. So it all sort of ends up there.
It's and when those, you know, antagonists do turn up, I mean, it really makes you wonder, you know, all bets are off, basically. You don't know, because they are such nasty characters, you just don't know who's going to survive and who isn't. You know, it's quite surprising the way the film actually does turn out.
Do you remember the guys in Drive, the bad guys, the double act of bad guys in Drive?
No, not
with
really.
With Mark Dacascos. No, you don't remember? Oh, anyway.
It's been a while since I've seen that one.
Oh, you've got to watch Drive again. Let's catch up on that. So the guys in this predates Drive, but they really have a sort of a similar dynamic, which I guess is kind of a common bad guy and his underling or, you know, sidekick kind of relationship. But he's got this really scuzzy guy. He's like a complete psycho. He gets stabbed in the leg and he just thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And
it's also like there's the two guys in Blade of Fury as well. Sorry, Blind Fury.
Blind Fury. Oh, yeah. I don't think I've seen that for many, many years. I was actually thinking of watching Wanted Dead or Alive the other day, but Blind Fury, I don't know. Yeah. Amazon.
Yes, sorry.
The main bad guy, who's just known as Sir, is played by Barry Lynch, who I didn't realise is Richard Lynch's brother.
He does kind of look similar to him.
He does, absolutely. I don't know why I never picked up on him. But he's walking around. He's got this character trait where he combs his hair all the time. He's constantly trying to look refined and sensible, but he's really, you know, he's no better than the people he's working with. One of whom is Clint Howard, and boy, does he get put through the ringer in this one.
Yeah, I'm infested.
That's one of the best lines in the film. There's loads of really good lines, like "When in doubt, squish" and that. Mm. But the "I'm infested" part is really memorable.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's up there with what was it? Something's not right with me from Slither. You know,
and he's Clint's. He's in it basically for the first hour, I'd say. His character doesn't die quickly.
He suffers a lot.
He gets introduced. He's the first victim, but he doesn't just get the ticks running and trying to, you know, bite him or anything. They like bite him, and then he gets unconscious, and then they're buried in within him, and then he's trying to shoot them within his body, and then they're in his face, and he doesn't even get to. He's desperate to try and kill himself and whatever, and he doesn't even get much luck at that. So I felt really sorry for the guy. But Clint Howard's great, and we also get his other brother Rance Howard as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Playing the sheriff. So the casting is great. I mean, there's loads of really good people. Peter Scolari. Who else? Amy Delenz, who's quite high build. Funnily enough, we were covering an Amy Delenz film on the last episode. But she's very much sort of a supporting character in the background. She doesn't really get a lot to do in this. There's a couple of other female characters who are much more important. Amy Delenz's character is just kind of the, what would you say, like, you know, like Charisma Carpenter in Buffy? Kind of.
Is she the posh one?
She's the posh one, yeah.
The socialite one, yeah.
Yeah, the socialite kind of one with the boyfriend with the abs and stuff. But that goes back to the whole thing, you know. It's like, oh, they find some steroids, and then, you know, they're talking about the steroids being used for the, you know, the production, which then impacts the ticks, and then the guy, another character, takes the steroids, and they in turn have another evolving effect. So we get a brilliant giant tick climax, which is very similar to an effect from Nightmare on Elm Street 4, which I think KMB also.
Oh yeah, when the woman turns into a cockroach.
So there's a lot of, I mean, this is top notch visual effects. You know, probably a little bit of CGI to a certain extent, I suppose, potentially. But this is before they did all of that. You know, this is not like Eight-Legged Freaks
practical fire effects, I think. You know, if anything was green screened or anything like that, it'd be the fire effects.
It's lots of models and miniatures and stuff. It's all the best old school techniques, really, and a great showcase. I mean, the film was, I believe, and they probably go into this on the Good Bad Flicks, but it seems it was conceived for the ticks by Doug Bestwick, who's the visual effects supervisor, and the script was written by Brent V. Friedman, who's done absolutely tons of stuff.
That name sounds so familiar,
He's done tons, including like the Chuck Norris film Hellbound and Mortal Kombat Annihilation. He created co-created the show Dark Skies, which I watched back in the day. It was one of those X-Files kind of cash-ins.
Operation Blue Book, wasn't it? That was the premise of that one.
Yeah, the whole Majestic stuff.
I want to mention the director, Tony Randall. Now, his first film, according to IMDb, he's uncredited on this, but he apparently directed DEFCON 4. Have you ever seen that one?
I haven't, no. I mean, I've heard of it, but I've never seen
it. It is bleak, you know. it's like a really bleak Mad Max movie kind of thing. It's about a crew based on a spacebound sort of arsenal. You know, like Reagan back in the day wanted a Star Wars program of sort of missiles pointing back down to the Earth, and it's that sort of thing. And World War III happens, and they have to launch all their missiles, and then after like a year of sort of afterwards, they end up sort of crashing back on Earth and find out that this sort of rich kid who was at the local military academy has taken over. And it is bleak, you know. It's a really bleak kind of sort of actiony sort of film, but it's sort of stuck with me forever, that one. I think it's Canadian, it's worth checking out if you can find it.
Yeah, his background was as visual effects, I think, originally, like working with like Roger Corman, Battle Beyond the Stars and stuff like that.
And I think that helps with this sort of film, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
He knows how to work with effects, so he's going to be able to sort of, you know, direct them to the best of his abilities.
Well, his first proper credit was Hellbound Hellraiser 2, I should say.
Yeah. Now, that's a film I want to revisit, because I haven't seen that since I saw it at the cinema back in the day. So.
But he kind of, it's weird how his career went, or has gone, I should say, because he's still around. But the so he was doing horror, and and he did Hellraiser 2, he did this, and then
Fist of the North Star.
Fist of the North Star with Gary Daniels, which was a real curio. And again, another film very much of its time, and in a certain sense ahead of its time, because nobody was really doing those kind of manga adaptation kind of things at that point. I mean, they still don't do a lot of it, but, you know, had Malcolm McDowell, I think, as a martial arts master.
Chris Penn
was in it. And those are people very, very, you mentioned like Mad Max kind of stuff earlier, and that was sort of quite Mad Max-y.
Yeah, that's what I was going for, isn't it? Yeah.
But the, after about 1995, it seemed like he, you know, he moved away from more, he did, I think he might have done a few horrors, but.
Yeah, it's going all sort of TV movies and
In the last few years, it's kind of producing and occasionally directing, you know, sort of family fare, really. And I'd love to see him do another gooey horror movie again. You know, that would be absolutely amazing, because he was one of the guys. You know, that around that time, you know, the 80s, early 90s, you know, he was one of the names. You know, you saw that on the film, like a film like this and whatever, and you wanted to see it.
Absolutely. Same with the name Brian Yuzna back then, you know.
Absolutely,
You know, seeing his name attached to something, it'd be like, yes, you know, sign me up, you know, here's my money.
Yeah, there was, and then kind of things went a little bit off the rails with his stuff, I think, you know, after the two, you know, when he went to Spain, Fantastic right, Factory yeah. and all that sort of stuff, there were some that were decent, but others not so much, and then many of them were never even distributed, I think. That's over true. Here, so we just sort of lost his stuff. There's one called Amphibious that turned up recently on Amazon, but I've heard it's not that good. But anyway, I digress. He did like Society and stuff, and so it does have those sort of Yuzna elements in there and that. But I think this is very much. I think you can see it very much as Tony Randall's film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Seth Green's good as the sympathetic, you know, troubled teen. And I say I really liked all the other characters. You know, you don't necessarily like the characters, but they're really good characters and they're well sort of fleshed out within the limited running time. It's just there's no fat on this, I don't think, at all.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's very lean. You know, it lets you know exactly what it's about straight away. And gets on with the business, basically. You know, it's not one of those films where you're crying about when you're going to get to the fireworks factory. This film is all about the fireworks. It really is, you know.
And we even get the, at the end, the film kind of just, we leave the characters, and that's it. Mm. The film's ended. But we get a little, Christine moment, you know, which is like a setup for a sequel that would never come, almost.
It could almost
be more of a suspense ending.
It could almost have had, like, the word the end come up and then suddenly a question mark next to it. The end.
But I'm kind of glad they never did that. I don't know if they did it with the intention of ever doing another one. I think it was just sort of a bit of a fun payoff.
Like throwaway flight, you know, things.
Yeah, but being the way things are these days, that would usually be, we've got to do the next one.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this film was a success or not, but I presume it was because... It seems quite highly regarded.
I don't think
we're mentioning a film that, you know, people in the know haven't heard of before. I think this is quite a known quantity.
People of an age, I'm sure. You know, grew up during the 90s.
Picked up on Producer Video in 1990.
If you're a horror fan, you'd have seen the trailer and you'd have sought it out. We don't score the throwback section.
You know we love it, though.
But we love it. That's why we're talking about it.
And if you haven't seen it in ages, go and check it out.
It's there on Amazon Prime.
And it was in widescreen as well.
Yeah. So go check it out. We heartily recommend it. Okay, so that was our show for this week. Thank you for listening. If you're interested in knowing what's happening in the charts or what's coming soon, check out our Twitter feed and our Facebook page. Just search for the DTV Digest on both platforms and you'll find us, if that is you're already not a subscriber. Otherwise, tune in to our next episode, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.